Hi everyone, this is episode 2 of the Welcome To podcast. Before we get into it today with our guest, Dr. Rex Lamore, I wanted to talk about a project that the Land Information Access Association, or LIA, has coming up. We're ready to start working on it by the end of the year, and this grant opportunity goes through the end of 2020. All the work has to be done at that time. So as you may or may not know, we have worked on a lot of coastal resilience projects in the past. That's one of the things that we've really focused on in the last few years, working with the Coastal Zone Management Program, our partners at the University of Michigan and Michigan Tech University. We've developed a lot of best practices around planning for coastal resilience. And we have a current 50-50 matching grant opportunity that we'd like to promote right now. And we sort of structured it. We'll work with you to figure out what you want to do. First of all, you have to be a coastal community to apply for this project work. And we really structured it around three options for communities. The first is a full master plan update that would include a coastal resilience chapter, so we can help you update your master plan. The second option is that we can add a coastal resilience chapter to your master plan, and that would include a build-out analysis with hazardous areas mapped, so you can improve your hazard mitigation based on your current zoning and where new developments might go in. We also look at heat vulnerability and vulnerable populations, and really just try to make it so that if you're a coastal community and you're going to be dealing with climate change, which all of Michigan will be in the near future, and currently is, with all of the storms and the increased flood risks around the state, we can help you add that chapter to your master plan so that you're more sustainable in that sense. The third option is we've developed an assessment tool for community sustainability, and that covers everything from economic development, business attraction, business retention, job training for people, helping you figure out what your economic base is and how you can improve on that or diversify your economic base. It also looks at social equity. It includes, obviously, coastal resilience, environmental best practices, energy efficiency, everything we could think of that really covers overall community sustainability. We can work with you to do an assessment of your community to find opportunities and gaps in your sustainability and help you plan for that so that you can be sustainable well into the future. So with that, if you have any questions about that project opportunity that we're working on with CZM, or you have any questions about anything that's discussed in the podcast or any planning questions in general, as always, feel free to reach out. You can email me at zvega@liaa.org. That's zvega@liaa.org. Today's episode, episode 2, is with Dr. Rex Lamore. Rex is a really unique person. He created his own word, which not everyone can brag that they've done that. He is the creator of this idea of domecology, which is a study of the life cycle of structures, and this idea that the current way that we treat the life cycle of structures is that we take resources from nature, we build the structure, and then once that structure is no longer, it's surpassed its useful life, we demolish it and throw most of it in the landfill, and it's incredibly unsustainable. And so Rex is trying to figure out how we create a closed loop system where we no longer do it that way. We use recycled materials to build the structure, and then we design the structure to be deconstructed and reuse those materials again. So we're not constantly taking from nature, and we're not constantly putting tons of materials into landfills. Fun fact, Rex grew up on the street behind where I grew up in Saginaw. So we're both Saginaw guys. A lot of our research interests are focused on a lot of the issues that Saginaw has dealt with, especially loss of industry, property abandonment, and redevelopment in general. Those are really issues that Rex and I have in common. So unsurprisingly, when I was at MSU, I took Rex's class in domecology, really enjoyed it, and I wanted to have him on this podcast to spread the information that he's researching with other students and other researchers. He works with Dr. George Berghorn, who's also a professor in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction. He's a construction management professor. They work together on domecology to figure out what materials are most suited for deconstruction and just all the ways to establish an economy around this idea. So really interesting stuff. Rex runs the Center for Community and Economic Development through Michigan State. And again, he's a professor in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction. I really appreciated having him on to take the time to talk about this concept. I think it's an important one, and one that's going to, it's really going to take off once we establish it as a, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer when you think about it. So hopefully you guys enjoy the episode, and thanks again to Dr. Rex Lamore for joining me today. Thanks, guys.
All right, so yeah, we were talking about dome ecology. I took Rex's course in dome ecology at Michigan State last semester when I was in grad school, or last year when I was in grad school, and you just asked if I've been able to use it at all in my work. And it's a new concept, so that's kind of why we're here talking about it, so that we can get the idea out there. But I've been trying to incorporate it. Leah is working on a resilience tool for communities, so a comprehensive economic development, social equity, social making sure you have recreation, things like that. And I think dome ecology is one aspect of environmental sustainability that people aren't thinking about. So we typically don't think about how much waste is created by the fact that our housing, our commercial buildings, they have a life cycle. And if we don't consider what we're doing with those materials when they're either obsolete buildings or they're just not structurally sound anymore, how we can make it so that when that eventually has to go to the landfill, we're hopefully rerouting as much material or recycling as much material as possible. So that's why I'm glad that I'm talking to Rex right now, because he created the word dome ecology. So let's start out with, what is dome ecology? There's some Greek or Latin roots in there, so let's break it down. First of all, what does it mean? What are we talking about?
Well, basically, the term is trying to capture the basic concept that the built environment has a life cycle in which there is somewhat a predictable end of useful life for most structures that we build, and that when we plan, design, construct, reuse, and eventually deconstruct those structures, we should have that life cycle in mind so that we maximize the reuse of the materials wherever feasible and minimize the negative impacts that would be associated with abandonment and blight and the economic, social, and environmental impacts that surround that. So dome ecology is an effort to really help us as thinkers and doers in planning and community development to re-envision the built environment so that we incorporate that life cycle planning into that process.
And so we're looking at it from obviously a life cycle perspective. So what is the current issue right now in terms of how we're using the built environment and how we're, I guess, constructing buildings and deconstructing buildings? What's the issue with how we're doing it currently, and why do we need to change it?
Yep, multiple issues surface in our current paradigm, which is a more linear paradigm of build it, use it, and then at the point of its end of useful life, unfortunately, in many cases, it's abandoned. And at that point, in many cases, the public sector has a responsibility to remove that structure, or it just sits there and decays, and then eventually, maybe over a period of time, it's removed. And of course, Michiganders very well know the presence of blight and abandonment. I mean, it's pervasive throughout our state, both the residential, commercial, and industrial properties that have gone out of use, and we see those. And so dome ecologists try to think of these things in a way that, can we, again, maximize the value out of those abandoned structures and find ways to repurpose that materials. And additionally, and this is some of the more emerging work that we're trying to do in advancing this way of thinking, can we find ways to finance the removal of these structures so such that the burden doesn't fall on the general taxpayer, which is where it falls right now. When a structure is abandoned by a private owner or business over a period of time, if that business cannot be tracked down or that owner cannot be tracked down and held accountable for the removal of that structure, the public ends up paying for the removal of that blighted structure. And in some cases, particularly with contaminated industrial sites, that can get extremely expensive, and as many community and economic developers know. So in a lot of cases, this stuff just sits there for decades, literally, until there's some available resource that can allow us to remove that. So we're trying to rethink the paradigm so that during the useful life of the structure, we also think about ways that we can finance the end of the removal, removal of the structure at the end of its useful life. And a couple of ideas that we've come up with, Zach, and as a certified dome ecologist, I think you know these things. One is bonding. And this is done now. We bond, local governments can bond such things as cell towers and the wind turbines for electric generation and other structures like that that present a clear health and safety hazard. So at the point of construction, we ask the firm that builds these things to secure a bond so that at the end of the life of that structure, the community has a resource to pay for the removal of that. And that could also be applied to other structures as well, other developments that might occur. And then the other concept we're looking at is other ways that we might be able to finance the removal, like through something like an innovative insurance policy, that during the useful life of the structure, the owner users of the structure pay a premium to a third party, an insurance company, for example, that monitors the use of the structure, and then at the end of the useful life is there to remove the structure. One of the advantages of that is if there's some contamination that might occur during that process, that insurance company, just like if you are a bad auto a car driver and you get tickets, your insurance premium goes up. The same thing would occur in this sort of third-party scenario where your premium might go up to, again, pay for the cleanup of the site and the return of that site to its useful character so that the community can reuse that property. So, and then there are a number of other elements that come to this. So, for example, some of the challenges that we're facing in dome ecology right now are finding value in what we call the high-volume, low-value material in these structures. If you think about residential properties in particular, most of that is a wood product. The studs in the walls and the siding, are there ways that we can reuse that material in such a way that it has value? And if it has value, we're not likely to throw it away. So one of our colleagues, as you know, Dr. Berghorn, in our construction management program, over the next several months, with support from the Michigan Department of Energy or Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, will be conducting research on the possible reuse of that wood in cross-laminated beams. So can we salvage this wood, pull it together in a cross-laminated beam, and then reuse that in construction of a new facility? And that's kind of exciting, because if we can find reuses for this wood, we won't throw it away. Similarly, with things like asphalt shingles and PVC piping and vinyl siding, again, these are somewhat high-volume, low-value materials that are pulled out of structures that have reached their end of useful life, and then again, can we find reuse for those? The other part of that we're working with the Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy is supporting the salvage sector across the spectrum of collecting the material to repurposing and reselling it. So that salvage and reuse industry sector, can we build their efficiency and effectiveness to be very good at moving this material? If we collect the material, we got to have some way to reuse it, otherwise it just piles up. And that's not what we're heading towards either. We want to create that more circular economy around structural materials such that when we salvage the materials from structures who have reached their useful end of life, then we reuse that material to the extent feasible. So having an efficient and effective salvage sector that takes that material, finds markets, finds reuses for it, and is successful in repurposing and reselling this material is critical to our capacity to end this plague of blight that we experience.
And to sort of rethink, you said keep it in a closed loop system of materials, and what we have right now is really linear in that we extract materials, we use them for a house, that house is no longer structurally sound, so we get rid of those materials and they end up in a landfill forever, essentially.
Exactly.
And yeah, trying to figure out how to get those materials back into a useful cycle. And are there any, what's the market look like that for right now? What would that take? Is that sort of a regional market or statewide, or would a local municipality have a program in place? What would that look
like? Good question. For some of the materials, you want it as local as possible because they are voluminous, they weigh a lot, and it costs money to move this stuff. And so it really places pressure on the local region to try to find as much reuse capacity as possible, because the farther you transport it, the less value added you get out of it. So you don't want to be moving piles of wood long ways. You want to try to find reuses. So for some of the materials, that is the most efficient strategy. Other materials, and we see this now, we just don't recognize it much. I mean, think about the scrappers. When a structure goes out of use, the scrappers, legally or illegally, are in there pulling out the valued materials like the copper piping and whatever else might be the metals. That goes right away into the reuse economy. And that can move a little farther because it has higher value on a reuse level. So primarily, we think, and again, we're just now, the field is an evolving field, as you well know. We believe that it's probably going to be partially a local initiative, but also a regional initiative, particularly where there might be high levels of material and perhaps other levels of demand. So part of what can happen at the local level, for example, is supporting those reuse, salvage reuse businesses, and also encouraging, and this is where local governments can play an important role, the reuse of this material in any new construction that might be going on. Again, you try to create a market for the reuse. So local governments that, for example, might be doing road work, they might find reuse for aggregate material that's pulled out of a facility, you know, the cement and other aggregate material that could be ground up and reused in road surfacing work. That is a reuse, and that's, again, something you probably don't want to move very far because it's fairly expensive. So there's an example. But if local governments were encouraging the reuse of salvaged aggregate as opposed to new aggregate, that might encourage, again, create a market for that salvage sector. Similarly, with other items that come out of these structures, like the wood and the asphalt shingles and the PVC piping. Again, local governments can encourage the possible reuse. Some parts of the United States, for example, in any proposed demolition, they will ask that the owner do an assessment of what might be salvaged and reused. And they actually give they conduct an assessment like an energy audit, only it's a salvage material audit. And they will give the owner an estimate of what the value of the material might be that they would salvage and perhaps donate to a reuse facility in the region. And that encourages, again, that salvage and reuse. So that's the kinds of things that locals can help us with in making this a more circular economy.
So is there anyone in Michigan who currently does that in terms of, because it seems like it would be a cost-benefit analysis of how much the material in your home is worth that could be salvaged compared to the cost that it would, because it's going to take more time and effort by whoever's deconstructing the house to more time, more money to get those materials out as opposed to how they normally. So let's talk, can we talk about the difference between just a demolition and a deconstruction and what that looks like and why one costs more than the other?
Yep. Let me try to answer your first question though, which is anybody doing this? Mm-hmm. And yes, in some respects it is already being done, but it's in a very narrow thread of the structural salvage industry, and it's the steel that comes out of many of the industrial properties that are abandoned. It's a rather curious phenomenon, and I don't think most folks know this, that when some of these industrial structures go down and are no longer being used, they aren't, in the cases where there aren't large contamination issues, there are outside industries that will bid to get the steel out and resell it. So there is a market for that material, steel and the metals in these things. And that's a fairly mature industry in our state, where we have a number of businesses, fairly large businesses, that make that are good at that and salvage that material. In other sectors, how particularly residential and commercial sectors, we don't see that that mature sector yet, which is what we're striving towards. So, in regards to your second question, what was it again?
Demolition and deconstruction.
Oh, yeah, the cost relates to the variable. Yeah, demolition is the quickest and the fastest, cheapest way currently to remove structures. But again, that externalizes a lot of the cost of that removal. For example, as you pointed out, this stuff goes into the landfill and there it sits. I mean, and, you know, that may add to greenhouse gas emissions, depending on the way that the landfill manages the decomposition of organic material. But, you know, that's the cheapest and the fastest. Deconstruction, which is generally described as reverse construction, does require a specific skill set, is a little bit more dangerous for the workers who are involved in deconstructions, because they're actually in the structure moving the materials out, so there has to be some safety awareness going on. And there is potential exposure to contaminants. That's also in demolition, by the way. There is evidence that when we knock down older residential properties that may have lead paint affiliated with them, that you might get a lead plume in the air that could cause some health concerns, particularly if there's a large number of properties coming down. And that's one of the reasons that it's recommended that you use wet demolition methods, so you spray the dust down so that you don't get that kind of bloom. But you're right in that it, in general, on a per structural cost, demolition is the quickest and the fastest, but it doesn't take into account things like the need for new materials that we draw upon because we've lost the existing resource base. So the accounting is a little bit different. Deconstruction does provide employment and training opportunities, particularly for entry workers who might want to gain skills in the construction industry. Again, it's just reverse construction pretty much. So you can use it as a workforce training tool. So you can demolish, deconstruct structures and bring them back to, salvage the materials and train people so that they can help you in the construction of new buildings and new infrastructure. So there is a cost-benefit analysis that right now works in the favor of demolition. But again, we've got to change that equation by increasing the demand for recycled materials and recognizing the value of that. And I think you've heard us talk about how if you want any of the old growth wood in Michigan, you got to look in the structures, because it's not in the forest anymore, because we've already taken it out, except for Hartwick Pines. But there's only a few places left in our state where we have the old growth wood, except in the buildings of our state. And that wood is unique in its characteristics and can be valued as reused materials.
So let's say that if people are listening and they're planners in their community in Michigan and they're concerned about the amount of materials that are entering the landfill from the community because they've got, maybe they've got hardest hit funds and they're going to be getting rid of a lot of structures that are ablated because of, population loss that pretty much almost every Michigan community experienced in the last 20 years. Are there any zoning tools, or could this be part of the master planning process? What could a community do to start incorporating domecological practices into their planning process?
Well, clearly you need to think about end of useful life as a part of new construction. If your community is experiencing new construction, you should be thinking about what do we do when these structures go out of their end of useful life, and how do we secure some benefit that we're not likely to end up paying for these structures. So some of what we've seen occurring at the local level, again, and with some structures like cell towers and turbines, and you can apply this bonding, we believe, to other structures. You can request a bond so that, you know, you secure that for the possible removal of the structure. You can, again, require some reuse of, you can ask, in your public structures where you have more control over the design and construction of the facility, you can encourage the reuse of salvaged material. You could also encourage the use of design for deconstruction, DFD, which is an architectural term. So you actually design the structure in such a way that at the end of the useful life, it's easier to take apart the components and reuse them. And as you know, it's as simple as using screws in some cases versus nailing because of the damage that's likely to occur to the material in removing a nail. So you could look at innovative design structures. The other thing that I think local governments should think about is their underground infrastructure. Many parts of our state are experiencing severe challenges with our underground infrastructure, the sewer, the water that is necessary for many of our communities that needs to be upgraded and reconditioned, to think about using a lot of the material that you would be normally removing in that upgrading and reconditioning and possibly reusing that. And again, that, a lot of that looks like cement piping that in some cases it might be ground up and reused in at the local level and save you some cost savings there. So those are some of the ways. And in road underlayments, again, if you're doing road improvements in your community, might there be ways to salvage aggregate in the community and use that as an underlayment in your road improvements and thus, again, saving some of the cost of the extraction of that raw material from a local mine or some other place that you might have to have it shipped in from.
It seems like the way to get people to design, I'm thinking about getting people to design for deconstruction. It seems like it would be difficult because when you think about how long people, if you've got a plot of land and you want to build a new house on it, typically people stay in their houses for 7 years or so. And with the cost of building right now, it's going to be more difficult to encourage people to take a different design route to be more environmentally conscious. So it seems like maybe that's going to take some incentives from a municipal level or maybe a state program, something like that. But when you were talking about the public buildings and how communities can design for deconstruction in that regard, that seems like it would be a more feasible approach to sort of introducing this idea into the local built environment and showing the benefits of it.
Yep. Clearly, when you own and control the design and construction phase through a public structure, it's a lot easier than trying to incentivize it through a private owner who you're incentivizing. How it is important to note that modular construction does lend itself to deconstruction more efficiently and effectively than stick-built construction. And modular construction.
What does that mean for those of us who aren't in the construction management field?
Yeah, good question. Sorry. Stick-built is the example where the contractor is building the residential structure in this particular example, board by board. Whereas modular construction is when the facility is perhaps constructed at a central location and the elements of the structure, like the walls and the roofs and the other windows, are brought to the site and connected together in a modular format. That type of construction is generally cheaper than stick-built and also lends itself to deconstruction more efficiently when a structure goes out of its useful life. And so to the extent that, you know, modular construction becomes more and more popular, and it is becoming more and more popular because there are cost savings and there are energy efficiency gains and then we may again see more capacity in the future to salvage these materials from the structures that we're currently building. That's one of the hopeful signs. So think about advancing modular construction to the extent you can. Now, there are challenges here, and I know you know these things as a certified domicologist. You know, this is a new field of study, a new field of thinking that we're trying to advance. And in doing that, we're conscious that there could be negative implications here. And one of the concerns that we've chatted about in our collective thinking around this topic is that clearly, one of the most efficient methods to facilitate deconstruction, structures like pole barns. I mean, pole barns lend themselves very well to efficient deconstruction. I'm pretty sure we don't want every structure to look like a pole barn. So we're going to want to keep an eye on our design characteristics as well, so we enhance the quality of life in our communities by advocating for good design quality and not just, yeah, in our haste to encourage material salvage and reuse, we don't end up with a world full of pole barns. I'm not sure that would be the place we'd want to end up. So we do need to put some critical thinking on this as well. So that's one element of concern that we might have as well.
So what are you guys currently working on right now? I haven't talked to you. I graduated, went away for a while, and I took a class my first year of grad school. So what have you guys been working on since then? I know you've got some students working for you on these projects. What are the updates?
Students and community partners. I mean, right. Our network in this regard, I mean, there's a growing awareness that this concept has many potential applications and implications for the built environment that many people find valuable in terms of thinking about the circular economy, thinking about the reduction in requiring virgin materials for new construction, thinking about the ways that we might salvage material from already built structures and reusing it in a more efficient way, reducing the pressure on our landfills. So we've got quite a bit of community, business, academic interests around this topical area as we kind of try to move forward on rethinking our built environment paradigm. Our current efforts are really focused on two aspects of this, and it's what we kind of describe as choke points that are really at this point in our evolution in this new form of thinking. Two choke points present themselves, and I sort of mentioned them earlier. One choke point is finding value in the high-volume, low-value material that we pull out of these structures. And again, I'm thinking primarily the residential structures where the predominant material that you pull out is wood. And we're not talking about the oak floors or the architecturally unique stuff that should be pulled out and salvaged and sent to an architectural salvage facility for the DIYers, do-it-yourselfers, to go and buy and put in their new homes or in their renovated homes. We're talking about the stuff that generally sits in the walls and the studs and the flooring and the material that generally doesn't get reused. So can we find other uses for that that add value? So that cross-laminated timber research will be going on over the next several months under the leadership of Dr. Berghorn here in our construction management program. And then another choke point that we are going to be focusing on, and there are other choke points other than this, is that sector, the reuse sector. How capable is our current salvage industry and reuse industry in terms of managing and reselling the materials and trying to understand that market as best as we can so that we can encourage them to be successful in reusing and salvaging materials and in creating a more vibrant market, a demand for this material on the consumer side so that, again, we find value in this material and we don't throw away things that we have value for. So those are the two choke points that we're kind of focusing on here in the near future. A third area, and this is not on the is an area that I would welcome the opportunity of local government area officials to be leaders in, because we need people to come forward and do these things, is to adopt policies at the local level that at a minimum ask people to do an assessment of what value they might get from the salvage material before implementing a renovation or a demolition. and or encouraging locals to begin to adopt practices that, say, in any new construction that we do or any renovation that we would fund, we would ask that a percentage of the materials used in that be salvaged materials. And that would be local governments acting on behalf of this concept, and we would encourage that. And we've got a couple of policy briefs on our webpage that describe what other parts of the United States have done to try to do that. So those are the things that we're sort of working on right now, Zach, to try to help advance the thinking and doing in the field of dome ecology and the work you're doing, and try and help others just even begin to think of this thing as a more circular rather than a linear paradigm, which is really unsustainable.
Do you think it's going to be a large private sector initiative that's going to get this off the ground, or do you think it's going to be the work of local officials, state government, all of the above? What roles is each one going to play? How do we get this going?
Good question. Yeah. Well, that is actually a really good question. It's going to take everybody, right? I mean, this is a fundamental rethinking of how we create our built environment. And, you know, what we think of the built environment as having. My sense of this is that, and this is, I think, held out by other examples, if the private sector grabs a hold of this, it'll go faster. I mean, yes, there are local government and maybe a few state government officials that are innovative leaders who are advancing innovative policies that might help move the concept further towards realization. But private sector leaders tend to be more responsive and quick to act, particularly if there's value to be made, profit to be made, if there's an opportunity. And I'll also say that on the consumer side, more and more people are asking questions about the environmental impact of certain products that they are consuming. And we believe there to be a growing market demand for businesses that behave in environmentally sustainable ways. And so to the extent that our construction industry and our hardware companies begin to demonstrate that, you know, we can use salvage materials and still accomplish a lot of what the consumer wants, I think that's going to drive us faster. And then, you know, the public sector will continue to hope that they get the idea and maybe advance some policies that can help move the system in the right direction. But it's going to take everybody. It's going to take consumers. It's going to take businesses. It's going to take public officials. It's going to take local government planners and just a lot of thinkers and doers to make it happen. But think about the alternative. If we don't move forward, I mean, we're continually placing demand on limited resources. Some are non-renewable. Some are renewable. And in the meantime, you know, we're disposing of what can be valuable resources. So again, if we're able to again maximize the reuse and the negative environmental and economic impacts of the throwaway culture, then, you know, this is a much more sustainable paradigm for our built environment over the long run.
And in terms of how unsustainable it is currently, off the top of your head, do you know, I think I asked you for this stat a while back, but the percent, it was pretty astronomical, the percent of our landfills that consists of demolished residential structure materials.
Yeah, the C&D waste estimates, construction and demolition waste estimates for landfilling is 25 to 40% of what enters landfills comes from this sector. And that's not only the demolition of an end-of-life structure, it's the material that accumulates in a new construction, you know, the ends that get cut off and all right. That goes to the landfill. So it's estimated between 25 and 40% of the volume of the materials that goes into landfills comes from this C&D track. And so it's pretty substantial. I mean, household waste is another element of that. And that's certainly a challenge for us as well. But the C&D piece is also an area of that waste stream.
Yeah, I think people think a lot about, you know, they want to recycle. They mm-hmm. want to make sure that they take their material, their household materials to the recycling facility. But they don't think about the fact that, you know, if they bought a new lot and they want to put a new house on it, they're not really thinking about where that waste is going. And that's a lot of material, and it's a lot of material, like you said, that potentially could be reused. I mean, and I know one of the dilemmas we talked about is, especially in Michigan, with the abandonment issue of having a lot of abandoned residential structures, the difficulty with that is that you've got a lot of houses that have been in decay for years before they're getting the attention that they need. And so a lot of that material, you know, maybe you have nice floors, but now they've got water damage. The wiring in the walls has fire damage that makes it obsolete. But it seems like the demolition efforts are sort of slowing down as the hardest hit funds are coming to an end. And so it seems like it's a good time to start thinking about how with the lower amount of demolition that we have to do, how we do that in a more environmentally friendly way.
Right. That's a good point. Yes, as you are correctly pointed out, hardest hit funds will be ending in next year. And many of our communities have relied on that to remove some of their most blighted structures. So the question now becomes, and then I don't know that anybody feels they've removed all of them, and I know all of us can identify an empty or abandoned structure, a commercial or industrial or residential in our communities. So then the question is, how do we pay for the removal of that? So you're right. Now, the good side of the ending of the hardest hit funds, not very good, is that we may have more flexibility if we're doing it locally and we have the capacity to do that. The downside, of course, is it's a resource that is desperately needed here in the Midwest. Part of this challenge is that this is somewhat a Midwest thing. This is kind of like us. I mean, this is not, the coasts don't have this problem. And parts of our state don't experience this to the extent that other parts of the state do. Because, you know, the coast, if a property goes out of use, somebody wants that land to build something else. And so there is usually a demand for that property in some of our – and so the East and West Coast generally have fairly high demand for land, and so properties generally don't sit vacant for very long. And that's true in some parts of Michigan as well. There is demand for the land in certain parts of the state, and so when a property goes out of use, somebody's going to tear it down and reuse it in some other use. In other parts of our state, because we certainly sprawl, you know, we leave things behind that we probably shouldn't leave. But I think, you know, another example, and I think people need to think about this, when you're reshingling your roof, which is a frequent activity for a homeowner every, you know, few years, every 5 to 10, 15 years, you know, what do you do with those shingles? You know, and that's something that goes into the landfill right now. But are there ways to reuse that such a way that we don't end it up in the landfill? So that's something that, and or when you're doing a renovation, you know, what do you do with that material? So it's something we can begin to think about through that life of the structure.
And to get those into a material reuse market, it seems like a chicken or the egg situation where there's not really an incentive, an economic incentive for people to deconstruct right now because they don't know, there's not a high value for these reused materials. But that's just because there's currently no established market for it, and you can't establish that market without deconstructing. So how do we coordinate these things to happen at the same time? Because it seems like that's really going to be the only way that we get this as an established practice.
You're right. I mean, you've nailed it. You know, the challenge we face, you know, we've got to have an efficient method to resell the material, but we have to have a demand for the material at the same time. Otherwise, you're just piling this stuff up. Actually, that happened in Milwaukee, where they adopted a local government ordinance that said any building built before 1929 must be deconstructed. No demolition of those older structures. They ran into a choke point where they didn't have enough deconstruction firms to actually take the material apart, the structures apart, or a market to buy all the reused materials. So they've put a hold on that ordinance until they can get a few more companies running for deconstruction. So yeah, it's going to take a period of time for us to create both the demand and the market system that will facilitate that. And, you know, as I mentioned, we're trying to focus on both sides. Can we find reuse for that high volume, low value material, particularly the wood, in the short term, and sort of reusing it in some form that might be of value? And then also, can we create a stronger reuse and salvage economy? The other thing that's occurring, and I know you have some awareness of this, as perhaps some of your listeners do, there's a growing consciousness of our environmental footprint. Consumers are beginning to ask more and more questions of, you know, how does this material reduce greenhouse gas emissions? How does this industry support, you know, green business practices? And so at the same time, we're trying to advance this form of thinking around the built environment. There's a growing consciousness in the general public that we need to behave differently around a number of items, including the built environment, that I think are encouraging signs that maybe there'll be a growing consumer demand for this.
Great. Are there any further thoughts on this, or do you think that summarizes it pretty well for the people?
No, I think you've done a good job. Hey, you're doing a great job, dolmacologist. Go out there and create more dolmacologists.
Where can people find information about this?
Yep, we have a webpage, dolmacology.msu.edu. Google it, and you'll find our webpage. And on that webpage, we've been gathering cases, examples, research, policies that others have adopted, that we've conducted. We encourage people to submit white papers of ideas. Again, this is an evolving concept, and again, we want to be thoughtful as we approach this practice. So if folks have critiques or comments, we welcome them submitting those, such that we, again, build our collective knowledge on what the potential implications of such a circular paradigm might be. And again, our Dolmacology webpage is a good place to start to gain more information and to help us build our collective information around this. So
great, and we'll post that link with the podcast on the LEO website. Thanks, Rex. Thanks for taking the time to talk about this. It's a great field of work, and thanks for taking the lead on it.
No, and thanks for your support too. Thank you.
Yep. All right.